Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University, the podcast of the MSU Deer Lab. I'm Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris.
And today we are going to talk about the impacts or potential impacts of predators on deer populations. You know, Steve, this has been a very, very common topic over the past decade and even longer. Both of us were in Texas for a while, and it's been a topic there for a long time. But in the eastern U.S., it's kind of a newer topic, whether it be on television, whether it be popular articles, whether it be hearing from hunters, and even in our scientific arena, there's now a lot of attention has been drawn to predators. So today, that's what we wanted to focus on. We wanted to make sure we developed a podcast and talk about, are they a widespread problem? Do you need to worry about it, and do you need to do anything about it? So Steve, why don't we start off with telling us, based on your experience and what you've seen and read, what's going on with predators in the eastern U.S. and how might they affect deer populations?
Well, coyotes, predators generally, can impact a deer population most significantly at the early stage in life, that what we call neonates, the newborn fawns. And during those first few days, they actually are very immobile. They'll get up and nurse and then, you know, walk a few dozen yards and find some more hiding habitat to crawl back into. During those first few days and the first week to 10 days of their lives there's usually a peak of predator loss, because they are essentially less able to run away. And in that time, you're finding coyotes in particular are very effective at finding fawns, particularly where there's limited, narrow areas of cover for them to hide in. Bobcats are also a significant factor, but they don't have that early peak typically that coyote predation does. Coyotes are very opportunistic feeders, and they're going to eat whatever is easy. They are the laziest of predators. And whatever they can find, if they can find a persimmon tree that's dropping a bunch of persimmon, they might just sit underneath that and eat the persimmon as they're landing on the ground. When there's a lot of fawns on the ground and they're in the peak of fawning, coyotes are focusing on fawns because there's plenty of them around. So the lazy coyote hitting fawns early. In some studies more recently, there's even been documentation of black bear, feral hogs eating fawns. So those opportunities there, those are probably opportunistic removals of fawns. I don't think black bear, feral hogs in particular, are just searching out fawns. But coyotes, when they get into the fawn searching mode, a lot of fawns on the ground, they'll actually hunt specifically for fawns.
You know, Steve, that reminds me of one of the classic behaviors that deer, as well as a lot of other deer species and ungulates, you know, they have what we call birth synchrony. And so that's one of the ways Mother Nature has kind of built that in, is that that's one benefit of does dropping fawns all at the same time or near time, is that you hopefully swamp the predators.
Yeah, that predator
swamp.
They
can't find them all.
Sure thing. And you know, the fawns themselves, I said they're immobile, but they're not exactly without a defense. It's more of a passive defense. During those first few days of life, once they sense a predator is near them, their heartbeat, which is beating around 120 110, 120 beats per minute, their heart rate will drop instantaneously down to 10 or 15 beats per minute. Their breathing rate, they almost stop breathing. They'll go a minute between breaths. And that is essentially a neurological process whereby they become less susceptible to being found. They try to be invisible. Because how does a coyote find a fawn? Well, they're going to be primarily sense of smell and sense of hearing. And if their heart rates are beating at 120 beats per minute, they don't. That's pretty loud, and they can be heard. And then the more they're breathing out air, respiring air, and then that air is coming out with a scent of fawn on them. So by shutting down their heart rate and their breathing, they become less susceptible to being found, which is pretty cool.
Oh, I was going to say another amazing tidbit about white-tailed deer. It's just fascinating. So I guess, Steve, in your order of impacts, what we think would be more widespread would be coyotes.
Yes.
Bobcats, even though bobcats are rarely shown to have as much of an impact, if ever, as coyotes. In some places, we have seen studies showing black bear can certainly be a significant predator of fawns, but across the range of the whitetails, they're not nearly as important as coyotes or bobcats.
That's right.
And certainly here in Mississippi, Louisiana, other places like that, where we unfortunately have a lot of feral hogs are indeed killing fawns, but we don't think to an extent that it's causing a population decline. It's certainly more opportunistic. Steve, before we move into the next section, I wanted to go ahead and get you to define a term, because we say it all the time. You're probably about to say it, whether you even know it or not, because it's part of our language, our vernacular as a biologist. What is fawn recruitment? Because we talk about all the time, measuring fawn recruitment. What is your fawn recruitment? Tell everybody what that is.
Okay, fawn recruitment is the ratio, essentially, of newborn, young of the year, to adult-aged females in the population. Now, an adult doe that is going to be fawning typically is a two-year-old doe. Now, you can't differentiate them very easily in a survey from a yearling, a one-and-a-half-year-old doe. So we lump one-and-a-half and two-and-a-half and older does as adult does. And so we're going to look at, in a survey, we'll estimate the number of fawns per adult-sized doe. And so you could record it as percent recruitment or percent fawn crop. That's, you know, say you have 100 adult does on the property and you have 90 fawns. That would be a 90% fawn crop. Now, an adult doe is going to, on average, give birth under ideal conditions, on average, 1.8 up to 1.9 fawns per 2.5 and older doe. So when you add in the yearling does, you're dropping that number, that productivity, down significantly. And then you have the losses. And so when we talk about a recruitment rate of 90%, that means, you know, by the time you get out to how many adult does, 2.5 and older, actually produce those fawns, it's a much higher rate per 2.5 and older doe.
Gotcha. What would be, if let's just say, and we're going to talk a lot more about this later in this episode, what are some general numbers? What have been some low recruitment rates you've seen? What have been some really high recruitment rates you've seen in the past?
Well, I've seen 140, 150% recruitment, meaning for every adult doe out there, you have 1.5 fawns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really high reproductive rate.
Population is ascending very fast.
Yes, it is going at that rate. It's probably going to be doubling every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
It's a very high rate of recruitment, expansion of the population.
How about on the low end?
On the low end, I've seen a property that I've personally surveyed out in Texas had 0% fawn recruitment
zero surviving fawns.
Fawns recruited in a particular year that was not a very good year by Texas standards, very dry, and they didn't have very good habitat on the property, so there was very little, poor nutrition, poor hiding cover, so you've got a double whammy, and
not to say they weren't pregnant.
Oh, no.
That's just that they had fawns.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we did reproductive surveys of adult bred does, and they had fawns.
Yeah, they just didn't live.
That's right.
Okay, so now we've established, of course, that predators are on the landscape, and predators are designed to predate. If they find a fawn, they're going to kill a fawn. Are they impacting deer populations? We're hearing a lot that some people, certainly in some studies that have been conducted, seem to show that. They are definitely impacting some populations. What do you think around the nation? What do you think is the average?
The average is just something that happens in between the extremes sometimes. There's been a lot of research looking at mortality rates of fawns associated with predators or due to predation. And some of those studies have been really extreme rates of predator loss, as much as 80% of the fawns being eaten in some studies. And so if you lose 80% of your fawns just from predators, that can be very significant. And especially if it's what we call additive to other sources of mortality. Some fawns are just going to be born a little less able to survive. Some are going to accidentally die. Some might have some parasite problems or disease. So there's going to be all kinds of mortality in a population. But if fawn loss to predators is compensatory, then it's not going to add to the overall mortality rate. And in a healthy, vibrant population with a high reproductive rate and a high recruitment rate, normally predation is not going to be additive, it's compensatory. But in a situation where you may not have really good habitat quality, you may have some nutritional limitations that are affecting the reproductive success, and you do have pile onto that predators, then you could really have some additive mortality from predation rates, and you could really have some significant impacts. And there have been some studies in the Southeast and showing declining deer populations due to full suite of problems and predators added on to those other problems.
The other thing to add on to that for populations that are indeed declining is hunter harvest. So, you know, in a lot of these populations you're talking about where this was really discovered is that hunters kept harvesting at the same rate,
sure,
you know, and it wasn't adjusted for that fawn predation that was occurring.
Yeah, and you talked earlier about, you know, coyotes in particular not being in the Southeast in the 1980s. They just started to come in the 1980s. And that was about the time when biologists, we were pushing heavy doe harvest to try to decrease the overabundance that had happened during the 60s and 70s. And so the coyotes are starting to come into the Southeast about the time that we're educating hunters and finally getting hunters to listen to us and start shooting an adequate number of does, antlerless harvest. And we were very effective at getting those hunters used to harvesting a lot of does during the 90s and into the 2000s. And the coyotes coming in the 80s, building up during the 90s, and the Southeast was ripe for a new predator because there hadn't been significant numbers of predators at that size of predator that would be impacting fawns. And you have a lot of small mammals that are also abundant. Coyotes come in, they find year-round abundance of something small enough to eat and something that they could, using their lazy hunting style, find easy enough. And so you got really greatly increasing predators.
So, Steve, there are definitely some places, both places we've been on, certainly a lot of studies we've seen, where I have no doubt whatsoever that coyotes and or other predators are impacting those populations. Whether it's causing the population to decline, you know, that's another factor, like you mentioned, that's going to be, are hunters still harvesting at the same rate, or can you minimize the doe harvest and maybe you can accept some level of predation and the deer population be just fine? In a nutshell, are coyotes and other predators impacting deer populations? I think we keep coming back to that answer you and I always give.
We love it.
It depends.
Absolutely.
Depends on where you're at. Depends on, probably has a bunch to do with your habitat conditions as well.
Yes. And in fact, why don't you talk a little bit about Kamen Campbell's research, which goes to that general question, are coyotes impacting fawn recruitment across a large area?
So we began that study, you know, it's funny now in hindsight, we started that study with a different intention, if you remember. And we were lucky enough that along the way, an MDWFMP biologist named William McKinley said, while you're doing this study on these properties, we ought to start getting some indexes of coyote and other predators on these properties we were studying. So we did, thank goodness. And so we had a range of 18 properties from the Mississippi River, west Mississippi, all the way into western Alabama, all the way from northern Mississippi to southern Mississippi. So we had geographically a really large area. And we had properties that are row crop agriculture all the way to pine forest and everything in between. So diversity of different vegetation and habitat types. And what we found was that there was no correlation whatsoever when we looked at the fawn recruitment rate on that property, and we related it back to the number of predators or an index of predator abundance on that property, we found no relationship. Now, absolutely, there were some places that had a lot of predators, and they had low fawn recruitment. But we had just as many places that had a whole bunch of predators, and fawn recruitment was just fine. So what that left us to conclude, Steve, is that, yeah, you can still have very healthy fawn recruitment in the presence of a lot of predators. And so we're left to conclude that it's habitat. You know, it's got to be the habitat conditions. If there's a lot of predators on the landscape, but there's nowhere for fawns to hide, then predators are certainly going to have an impact. But if there's places for fawns to hide, and the habitat is structured such that coyotes and other predators have got to look really, really hard to find them, then a lot of fawns are going to live. They're going to get away. You know, you and I were talking earlier about, Steve, about how that's so important with cover and the design of that and the shape of that. You know, whether it's a big patch or a big area of cover versus cover that's really, you know, our fancy word is linear. But basically, is it a strip? Do you have a strip of cover or an area of cover? Remember what we were talking about with that earlier?
Yeah, well, if you have a predator like coyotes that oftentimes hunt in groups, small groups, and they can go along a long strip of habitat, they can easily find fawns that are in a narrow strip of habitat. Whereas if you had a broader expanse of hiding cover, and you know, when we're talking about hiding cover, we're talking about dense vegetation up to 2 to 3 feet tall, basically up to your top, above your knees,
mm-hmm.
calf high,
between your knee and your waist.
That's right. And if you don't have good ground cover at that level over a large expanse of habitat, then you don't have good fawning hiding habitat.
Okay, Steve, so I don't think there's any doubt that predators are here to stay. What do you think is the big picture for deer populations and for deer management?
Well, that's a good question, Bronson. You know, so often we get tied up into our own world of what's important to me. And I think it is important to take a perspective at larger scales than my individual property that I hunt on. And looking across the eastern United States, we have generally declining deer hunter numbers, aging hunters, more hunters are getting out of hunting because of age, When deer hunters get older, they don't want to shoot as many deer because it's too much work. So we have, you know, a problem with harvest numbers of deer going forward. We have some real problems in many areas where there are too many deer. Just looking at some of the insurance company data, 1.2 million collisions in 2009 with deer. And that was up almost 20% from 5 years earlier. So we have problems with too many deer in many places. And so coyotes can actually help us to alleviate some of those problems. A growing management issue for deer throughout the United States is urban deer populations. And how do you manage those? And so problems with deer continue to expand. Crop depredation. Soybeans are a great forage for deer. They love it. And soybean farmers don't like deer coming in. Many people complain about home ornamental damage and in those urban areas, rural urban interfaces. So we have some real problems and with deer numbers going forward. And, you know, having coyotes come in generally will help alleviate some of those problems in the future. It's also going to end up with a little more foo-foo dogs getting eaten by the coyotes in those urban areas. And your cats might disappear. But, you know, that's part of the big picture is
having predators on the landscape.
Yeah.
That's just a side effect.
That's right. You know, deer were so successful expanding after restoration in the mid-1900s because predators weren't on the landscape. Now they're back, and we have to learn how to integrate and deal with them. But, you know, back to the local, the more focused view, you know, our listeners are deer nuts, and they're hunters, and they have properties, and I want to know what, do I have a problem on my property? How do I go about evaluating that question?
Well, first of all, a hunter, a group of hunters, a manager, what they're going to need to determine is, you know, we've been talking a lot specifically here with predators, but first of all, we need to find out, do you have a fawn recruitment problem? Because essentially, if you have predators on the landscape, you're seeing predators on your trail cameras, you're seeing predators while you're hunting, really not that big of a deal. Unless they are limiting fawn recruitment such that, you know, your deer population is suffering. So there's not a one-to-one correspondence here. Just because you see coyotes, as we talked about with Cayman's project earlier, mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have a recruitment problem. So you got to determine, do you have a recruitment problem? And that requires collecting data. And you know what our mantra is, you can't manage what you don't measure. And so you've got to take some measurements. You got to collect data. And a biologist or someone, you know, very, very informed in how to interpret data, they can look at those data and tell you, I've got a fawn recruitment problem because nutrition is limited. Or I've got a fawn recruitment problem because too many predators. A biologist can look at those types of data and discern where the issues are occurring.
What kind of data would they want to look at?
It's the most common ones. In terms of looking at deer condition, body weight is going to be one. So here's an example of, do I have a deer nutrition problem limiting recruitment, or do I have a predator problem? If your body weights are in fantastic shape, I mean, if you're at average or above average, your surrounding area, but your recruitment is very, very low, well, that's probably going to point you towards a predator problem. But at the same place, if you've got recruitment rates that are really low, you know, your fawn-to-doe ratios have always been low, that's probably been a chronic nutrition problem. You know, you need to increase habitat quality, increase food. The other part on the reproductive side, there's essentially three types of data we use. Historically, the method has been lactation data. And that is simply the hunter or the person that harvests the deer examining the udder of the doe, and it can either be pinched or squeezed, or sometimes you can even cut it open. And if there's anything that resembles milk, sometimes it's obvious milk, just by squeezing the udder, milk will come out. But other times you can cut the udder And it may not be this beautiful white milk, but there's enough fluid in there to know that, yes, this adult doe did lactate. One thing that's important with this is the time of harvest when the doe was harvested. So as you go, depending on where you're at in the country, when fawning dates were, and when the hunting season is, when you get to the middle or even the end of hunting season, even if that doe lactated and that fawn was recruited into the population, you may not be able to tell that she did. So,
because of the normal weaning process of the fawn, right?
That's exactly right. So she's not going to keep a full udder of milk year-round. As soon as the weaning process occurs, the size of the udder is going to get smaller and smaller and regress until, you know, eventually it's gone. So yeah, you want to, when you're using lactation data to drive this decision, you want to collect does as early in the season as possible. That gives you much more reliable data. And, you know, something, Steve, we just finished up to help managers is we actually have an equation that you can apply based on the average harvest date of the does on your property. You can apply this little equation and it'll kind of correct for you. And lactation can go up or down based on the probability of you even detecting it or not. But the main thing that people can do is harvest does as soon as you can.
Okay.
That's just another one of those things people can do. And if you harvest does late in the year, you may not want to use those to base this fawn recruitment decision upon.
So is there a cutoff time beyond which you don't want to use data? Because a lot of people, you know, they may be hunting wide range of geographical areas across the eastern U.S. and a lot of variation in breeding dates. About how many months past peak fawning time should you cut off your data?
Well, what we do here is, you know, our peak fawning, you know, it varies a lot in Mississippi. So you could have some fawning in July. A lot of it's going to be in August. Some of it can be even in September. So I think really when you start getting 3 and certainly 4 months past peak fawning date, I don't know if I would use those lactation data.
Okay.
The other, and again, this is a traditional method, but most people don't use it. And this was actually the reason we developed the Deer Hunt app is observation data. One of the best forms of data that can be collected on a property, not just for reproduction, but just for deer density, deer sightings, buck age structure. Observation data is just simply a hunter while they hunt recording the number and types of deer they see. Now, the thing about it is a lot of hunters will do that. They can take an index card or a form with them, or if they remember very well, they can get back to the hunting camp and write it down. But when it gets to be the end of the season, and you've got literally, if you have a big hunting club, you have hundreds and sometimes thousands of hunts that have been logged over the season.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to sit down and enter all those data and then run the stats on it and figure all that out. That's why we developed the Deer Hunt app. One of the many reasons, but I know I sat frustrated, thought this is for the birds, the way I'm entering all these data in, there's got to be a better way. And like, gosh, there is a better way. We need an app to do that. So that's one thing we can help you, the MSU Deer Lab can help you with this observation data because it's so important. And relative to this issue with fawn recruitment, one of the metrics that you record on the app is the number of fawns seen per doe. And so when those are collected across the hunting season by a number of hunters, and you start doing that year after year, you get a very reliable index of what your fawn recruitment is. Gaining in popularity then are camera surveys. So most people have a trail camera right now and are using them. But rather than just using a trail camera to see if a particular buck is in the area or has this buck grown or what bucks are in the area, use it for management and use it to detect fawn recruitment. There's typically 2 times, Steve, as you know, when people will run a survey and what we recommend, a preseason and a postseason. And there's pros and cons to each one of those. So if you want to get cameras on the landscape before the season, again, to see what bucks are in your area, you can also count the number of fawns seen per doe. However, in our neck of the woods anyways, we always underestimate recruitment at that time of year. some of the fawns are going to be too young at that point in time to be accompanying their mother. And so typically you don't see the number of fawns you would see during the hunting season or after the deer season. The good thing about it, though, is when you see a fawn, you know it's a fawn.
Yeah.
They're spotted. Right. I mean, there's no issue with that whatsoever. And that's what can make the postseason so challenging, is that most of those fawns have lost their spots. A lot of those fawns, of course, have grown over a 3 and 4 month deer season. And you can have a difficult time in front of a camera discerning between, now, is that the adult doe or is that the fawn?
Yeah.
You also, depending on where you're at, now you've got to contend with shed bucks.
Yep.
And so now you might even misidentify some of the does may actually be shed bucks. But, you know, Steve, you and I are comfortable enough to do a postseason. We feel good enough by looking at those types of photos and making those calls. But if somebody is not comfortable, they may just want to rely on the preseason count and then assume that, hey, it's a little bit low and it might be higher.
Yeah. So there's three data sources that you can use, again, to review the lactation data collected from harvested does, and you want to do that as early in the season as possible.
Correct.
The observation by hunters, and that's probably you want to try to use that earlier season is better than really late season, maybe? Or does it matter to a hunter identification of fawns?
It would depend, I would say, property by property, just on the skill and experience of the hunter. But certainly, if there's a lot of observations, a lot of hunters are collecting data just in your archery season, then that may be grounds enough to have a good estimate there. But the earlier the better, always with any of these, the earlier the better.
It's a lot easier to for a hunter, when they see spots, to say that's a fawn. But one of the things I've noticed is that hunters, once the spots are gone, they're less apt to identify them as a fawn, because it comes down to the how educated and effective the individual hunters are, whether or not they want to make that call. And serious hunters that study the deer can make those decisions. You know, the kind of the run of the mill, maybe the non deer nut hunters.
Right.
They just, oh, it's spots, it's a fawn. If it's not, it's an adult.
And we frequently hear that within the year, within the hunting season, a fawn turns into a yearling.
Yeah.
Those are not the same animal, but when a fawn loses its spots, to a lot of people, all of a sudden it's a yearling. And of course, that's not the case. But Steve, that reminds me too, to help with this, we've got an aging guide on the MSU Deer Lab on our webpage, msudeerlab.com. We have a publication that they can download. We also have an app, if you're an iPhone user, that goes through some of this, the aging on the hoof technique, but a component of that is discerning fawns, how to determine a fawn relative to a doe. And Steve, on the camera survey part as well, you wanted to wrap up on with the three types of data. We've got a great publication that's free for download there, how to conduct a camera survey and the pros and cons of doing preseason, postseason, how to set it up, how to analyze the data. So if you go to the MSU Deer Lab website, you can find that as well.
That's MSUDERLAB.com.
.com. You spelled it out there, huh?
Yeah, sometimes I forget. So Bronson, suppose some of our listeners use those data, the observation data, the lactation data, the camera survey data, and it appears that they don't have nutritional problems, that they've had a drop in fawn recruitment associated with predators. What do they do about it once they've come to that conclusion?
Excellent question. So I have two ways to think about this, and I think there is the habitat side. So we want to manage for fawning cover, and then we also, the other side as well, let's just get rid of the predators. I like the habitat side because it's more sustainable. It could be a lot of effort up front. Oh, it will be a lot of effort up front. And it may take a year or two or three for that habitat change to develop and for it to come to fruition. But once you've got it for a while. And what is fawning cover? You know, that's the thing. We're on a we're on a podcast here, so we don't have pictures in front of our listeners right now, but we use the term, you know, early succession, early successional. So I guess people think after an area has been clear cut and walk away. In 2 or 3 years, you have a lot of ground cover, a lot of ground vegetation. And Steve, I was riding down the other road thinking about this topic, and there's a property near my house, and I thought, you know, this would be a really good way to demonstrate if you have fawn in your cover or not. If you and I were to go out to a piece of property, and I said, Steve, turn around, or Steve, close your eyes, and I took a basketball, and let's even say it's a basketball painted fluorescent orange, and I threw it 10 yards, 30 yards. Well, I probably couldn't throw
you
it 30 yards.
Yeah, you couldn't throw it 30 yards.
All right, let's go 15 yards. And say, all right, Steve, turn around, take a look. If you could not find that, if you could just not visibly see it, now you're working towards at least some decent ground cover.
Mm-hmm.
Think of a lot of the properties you work with, though. Steve, turn around, take a look. You're going to instantly spot it. There's nothing on the ground. So think about it in a way. You're growing vegetation to hide fawns and to also make it more difficult for coyotes when they hunt. And that's what we were talking about earlier, Steve, about I don't want my fawning cover just to be along a fence row. I don't want it to be just a strip of cover, because the coyote can hunt that really, really easy and find a fawn. So think of an area that you want to treat. And then that, how do you maintain it? Once you create that cover, you know, that sunlight hitting the ground and vegetation grows. And then once it starts to grow out of what we call ground cover or fawning cover, prescribe fire. You just burn it. And we can't say to burn it every 3 years or 5 years or 6 years, because it all depends on your climate, you know, and your soil and things like that. But, you know, work with a professional in your area, and they can tell you you need to burn it every 3 years or 5 years or something like that.
How about fields, old fields?
Perfect thing to do. Yeah, the perfect thing. I think it's going to depend on what the field was. So was it pasture grass? You know, then that may be slower to develop. You might need to kill some of that pasture. Think of your pasture grasses as really more sod-forming type. In the south, it's Bermuda grass. It's going to be Bahia grass. The further north you go, it's going to be more of a fescue. But you want some bare ground with your treatment, because you want those native plant seeds to give them an opportunity to germinate. So it might mean that if it's an old field that was just an old pasture, it might need some disking. It might need an herbicide treatment. But yeah, those are great places to start, an old field.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of places that have a lot of wooded cover, they may have all their open areas in food plots. So if you have closed canopy and then food plots, what do you do?
You're in trouble. In terms of predators, you're in trouble. So I think of this, Steve, as a lot of people in the South especially, is they lease the land. I might lease it from a timber company, very, very common. They can't just go in and say, hey, I would like to thin or clear cut this area and create some fawning cover. So that gets to me anyway, and you can provide your opinion, that's when you start leaning towards that second option. Now you just might have to hire a trapper. And depending on where you're at and depending on if it's a buddy or not, this could cost you a lot of money. In Mississippi anyway, in a lot of the South, the time when you need to trap is when the furs, the coyote furs, the predator furs, are of their poorest quality.
So why is that? Why can't you trap them in the wintertime when they're more prime? Why do you have to trap them other times?
The strongest evidence we've seen so far is when trapping can have an influence on fawn survival is trapping as close to the peak fawning date as possible. Because these coyotes, they move around so much and they're dispersed from place to place. So let's go to this property and we took out 20 coyotes 6 months ago. Well, heck, within that amount of time, new coyotes have dispersed and colonized the area that you supposedly cleaned up. So we try to coordinate removing those coyotes as soon as, close to when those fawns are being born as possible. And that the studies that we've seen, that's where we've seen the strongest support for when it's effective.
Okay.
About trapping as well, if you don't know anything about it, like I'm not a trapper. I mean, we work with trappers so forth and have for years, but just about every state has a trapping association. So in Mississippi or any other state, just Google fill in the blank state trappers association, and there's a group of people I'm sure you can call and work out some type of relationship for them to visit your property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you manage the vegetation if you can. If you can't, try to find a trapper through a state trapper association, and don't just have them come out in the wintertime and trap. Have them, you're probably going to have to pay them literally wages to come out and try to remove coyotes around the time that the fawning takes place.
And the other part of that too, Steve, as you know, it's got to be pretty darn intense. Just removing a few coyotes here and there, it isn't going to do that much for you. As we have seen scientifically with studies, it's got to be a pretty intense removal in these studies where we've seen an effect. But yeah, that's exactly right. So the last thing I would recommend here too is don't put the cart before the horse just because you've seen some coyotes or you've heard a pack howl, like we all do nowadays. Don't just assume you've got a problem. You need to make sure you have a fawn recruitment problem first before you spend money hiring a trapper to remove coyotes.
So collect data.
Collect data. That's your best defense. Determine if it's real or not, mm-hmm. real or perceived.
Yeah. Great.
Okay, Steve. Well, I think we've talked a bit now about predators. Hopefully we've informed people about what's going on in the range of the whitetail with predators, and hopefully we've brought everybody up to speed on what's going on and hopefully what they can do. We hope they will join us next time.
Because, you know, we might have another interesting topic to talk about.
We're going to have another episode coming up soon for Deer University, the podcast of the MSU Deer Lab. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.